We live. Craig Jones, my brother, how are you, man?
Yeah, good, good. How are you?
Everything good. Thanks for doing this in such short notice, man. I appreciate.
Oh, no worries. Thanks for having me on.
How's everything going? Do you live in New York, or you're still in Australia and back and forth? How does that work?
I made the move to New York full-time probably in March.
Okay.
But I spent probably 6 months here last year preparing for ADCC. So, I mean, I made the move. I'm waiting for my visa. But it's probably a good time to be stuck waiting for a visa because no one can travel anyway, right?
Exactly. And I was just going to say that, like, you made a move in March, like, pandemics blew up like just after that, right?
Yeah, very strange time to move to New York, right?
Right? Everybody moving away. How were you handling all of this? Well, training impacted to some level, right? Like you guys have a couple of good partners. You train all the. You don't have those giant Danaher classes in the morning, but. You still get some quality training, right? Like you train with Gordon, and those guys come over. We'll get some like private sessions there. How much that impacts your regular training?
I think to be honest, I think it's probably better than usual because like usually I would take maybe we do six rounds. I would have one or two hard rounds, but right now it's basically every round's pretty difficult. Mm-hmm. There's without the regular class. There's not too many rest rounds anymore.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
For me, I probably prefer it as well because Henzo is obviously so popular. There's too many people in the room sometimes. So you can't wrestle. You can't do a certain number of things. So, I mean, especially when I'm training with a guy like Nicky Rod, where we could end up, flying
all over the
room. Yeah. It's probably better right now, to be honest.
Yeah, that makes sense. Those 7 o'clock classes are packed, right? Like it's crazy.
Yeah, especially I think Monday is like the busiest one. Everyone travels to New York to do the double nogi morning and lunch.
Oh, that's right. I thought it was the Tuesday class because I think the Tuesday class is the one that George used to fly over to attend. I'm not sure if it's Tuesday or if it was Monday.
Yeah, true. I can't even remember anymore.
Yeah. Look, let's get that last week out of the way. The Submission Underground. What happened there, man? Like, everybody's talking about, I was watching, and everybody's like, oh, my God, this is... So, just kind of, like, describe it to us a little bit, what everybody saw it, but just, like, from your perspective.
Yeah, so I was making some noises from the body triangle. I was like when someone squeezes you and you're trying to move, you sort of can't help sometimes but make some noise. I think what made it sound particularly bad was the fact that there was no crowd. It was complete silence. So the referee was seeing Mason with his arms around my head, and he was assuming that I was in a neck crank. But it was to be honest, it was mainly just the squeeze of the body. My neck felt pretty safe. So him hearing that and then what Mason did, he obviously comes from an IBJJF background, so any vocalization is going to be considered a submission. So obviously ADCC and EBI is where I come from, where unless you say tap, no noises are going to be considered a submission. So as soon as I started grunting, Mason started screaming at the referee that I was verbal tapping. And the first time I grunted, the referee let it go. So then Mason retook the same grip, squeezed the exact same way, and on the second time I grunted, the referee called it. So I think Mason sort of encouraged the referee to take.
Yeah.
So I mean, it was a strange situation. Like the referee jumped in thinking I was in danger. So I mean, we cleared it up. So when we do a rematch, basically you have to say tap. And I mean, like a grunt, like people grunt all the time in rolls. Like I could imagine if I was screaming, the referee would stop up. But yeah, just a grunt. I don't know. It was just a confusing set of circumstances, sort of a bit of a letdown for Mason as well as me, because obviously a lot of people online sort of taken away the victory from him. So it feels incomplete.
Yeah. And I'm just surprised by there's this. It's a little of a nonsense call because, like, it's clear you didn't tap. I have no idea why this guy could not say, "Oh, all right, let's keep going then." Or if it doesn't believe it, just go check a little, like a quick replay or something like that, and watch. We don't use technology as much as we should for that kind of stuff, you know. I was just talking about the UFC fights, and how we've been getting so many fights, and there's some nights you see 3-4 like terrible decisions being called, and I think I had a Big Nog Minotauro on the podcast, and he's like a sort of an ambassador in Brazil for the UFC, and we were talking about bad calls and bad refs. Say, look, this guy should be removed from the arena, not for your case, but I'll get there. Say, removed from the arena, like soundproof cabins, and full technology there, like they can rewind and replay and see what happens. They did that punch connect and stuff like that, and come up with better decisions. And in the jiu-jitsu case, they should do the same, right? If it's questionable, nothing stops the guy. Say, hey guys, all right, give me a second. It goes there, check. It's like, no, he didn't tap, or no, he wasn't in, or whatever happened. And it's so easy. It's just as easy as stepping out, watching a phone or iPad or something, and come back and just remake the decision. But they have that thing in mind, right? It's like, once it's called, there's no coming back. And it just puts like a crazy victory run in jeopardy for something as silly as a
Yeah. I mean, they do it in freestyle wrestling, right? You can call them out and they'll do a video review. So it's like, they can do it in other grappling sports. I mean, I don't see why not. I mean, especially with an EBI overtime, like basically if I didn't submit, he still gets to start on my back if we go again.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, he's not losing any position or anything. EBI is probably the easiest one to restart.
Yes, that's true. That's true. How do you see you're a guy that was there. I remember Eddie Bravo talking about you and Gordon, and you guys were like coming up like prospects, right? Just a few years back. How crazy that turn became, and you guys are probably like, I keep saying like all the time, like out of the top 20, probably we have like 10 of those just training here at Hanzo's. And how did you see this wave like a jiu-jitsu and super fights and stuff like that? Like I talk to guys from MMA all the time. I say, dude, in your time you had to go fight MMA because there was no money in jiu-jitsu. It's like, yeah. I said, look at now. It's like, oh shit, no shit. Like guys don't need to do that turn anymore. And I read that you tried to you wanted to be like a UFC fighter at some point, right? And that's how you start training and that's totally out of your head now?
Yeah, pretty much. When I started training, I was just watching the UFC at the time. But, like, it was so long ago that the UFC, or MMA itself, was still illegal in Australia. So I was just like, well, I'll just dedicate myself to jiu-jitsu. And then by the time MMA was legalized, I was sort of hooked on jiu-jitsu. But, yeah, it's funny you say that. Like, most, you had a choice, basically, if you wanted to make money in jiu-jitsu for a time period. It was like, open an academy, and then that's going to be detrimental to your competition career, or go into MMA.
Yeah.
And then it sort of came out of nowhere. Meta Morris started, but I really believe the guy that really kicked it all off was probably Eddie Bravo.
I said that.
His connection to Joe Rogan.
Exactly. I said that to Eddie Bravo. I said, look, you are probably like the guy that there were some before, but I think what Eddie Bravo got was the consistency and kind of like it, and not developing, but showing talent, right? Like you and Gordon will come and everybody's like, who the fuck is this guy? He's fucking getting everyone, you know? And that got that thing, that ball rolling. We have so many good tournaments now. I had Hollis here. We're talking about Kasai and EBI, I think Eddie is going a different way now with the combat jiu-jitsu. Is that something you ever consider?
I thought about it, but it's just like it's not lucrative enough or not popular enough that I would want to change the way I train.
That makes sense.
I think potentially I could go in there without preparing for the slaps and still do pretty well, because it seems like a lot of guys that do win the combat are just jiu-jitsu guys and they don't even throw a strike.
Uh-huh.
But then on the other end, you got a guy like Wagner Hosha who finished Nathan Orchard with slaps from the mount. So
yep.
There's always the exception to the rule.
Or the fight that I always talked about that never happened, Verdun versus Gordon. I was like, that's fucking, it's going to be like one chance to each guy. Gordon's going to get Verdun's leg, or Verdun is going to slap Gordon, and whoever get it first is going to win the fight. That was a crazy match.
That would have been really exciting, right? But what happened with that? Verdun ended and Gordon injured himself or something? Yeah, could still do it one day.
It's cutting off. What was that? What would happen? What?
Oh, I said... Do you remember? Was it Gordon got injured? Is that why
someone got injured? I think it was Gordon. I think it was Gordon got injured for that fight. I could be wrong. It could be Verdun, but one of those two got injured for the fight. I was looking, and Gordon was training some striking and stuff like that at the time, and he used to talk a lot about going to MMA. I think that's gone too. I had Buchecha on a podcast. And he wants to go to MMA. He wants to do the MMA transition because he can see a potential pay increase or something like that. Rodolfo Vieira recently, not recently, probably like a couple of years now, but he also said, hey, I want different challenges and stuff like that. But it's just like you said, man. There's so much going on right now. You can make a great living competing jiu-jitsu, not getting punched in the face. It sounds a lot better, right?
Yeah, I think like what that last generation of guys missed out on in terms of the financial aspect was the instructional sales.
100%.
Like you could release an instructional product now that would be worth maybe like 3 or 4 UFC fights.
Yes.
Like if you're very popular, which a lot of these guys already are, so they're obviously getting good MMA contracts initially. Because the legends I watched coming up just missed the boat on the instructional sales. You know what I mean? There was so much money to be made. And I feel like lucky that I timed it right. Luckily for my age, it was a perfect timing of super fights and instructional products that offered a career that people didn't even know existed a few years back.
That's right. And plus you develop your own fan base and that's your kind of your public for those instructionals, right? That it doesn't have to be 100% of everyone that likes jiu-jitsu. I think that doesn't sync with these guys yet. They're like, well, how many of those I think I'm going to sell? So, well, if you have a good fan base, you sell like, I don't know, 5,000 at $100 each. Just think small, right? Those guys like, I'm not going to sell 1 million of those. I say, well, maybe you sell 5,000. Maybe you sell 2,000 at $100, $200 or whatever. Gordon makes a killing of it. You have one at BJJ Fanatics, right?
Yeah, I got a few. I just haven't released any for a while yet. I think like I released my first instructional and I got too caught up in trying to bring out other ones. So I've left it a bit of a gap. Mm. But like for these people, like if you have a $200 DVD, and you sell only 5,000 copies, that's already $1 million.
No shit. That's what I'm saying, right? It's so crazy money.
It's ridiculous. And the jiu-jitsu fan base, especially in America, it's so cult-like. People want to collect things. They want to collect all your DVDs and stuff. They want to be part of the community. So it's very, very lucrative.
Exactly. I see ads for your instructional popping up in every, I think like if you go to BJJ Heroes or something like that, I said, do you want to learn from, and it makes you feel bad actually. It's like, do you want to learn from Craig Jones? And then there's like, yes or no. And then it's just a pop-up window, right? And then I goes like, oh shit, I got to click no, because that's not what I'm here for now, right? So I click no and say, are you sure you don't want to learn from Craig Jones? I was like, all right, I'll learn from Craig Jones.
Yeah, that's I think that's Bernardo Ferrier.
Yeah,
marketing genius at play. Bernardo's as dedicated to internet marketing as he was to jiu-jitsu back in the day, I believe. Right.
Yeah, he made this whole his Instagram account. It's an awesome one to follow because he puts little little movements every day. I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was complaining. He was like, well, I don't have time, and to sit down and do a full instructional. I don't have a part. I said, dude, just and then I showed him Bernardo Faria Instagram and say, look, he shows a move every day. There's like even more than one move. That's all he posts. It's like, and it's like a minute, 2 minute videos. You can sit down and just watch, and that's it. I put some mats on my garage. I put a TV right next to it. And we do some Renzo Gracie Online Academy stuff, and I have like a 60 pound dummy, and that's kind of how we got our workout on. I was waiting because Hobson had something going with his knee, and he didn't want to push it, but now he's good. So now I'm going back to the city and training. That's how we actually met. I was there doing a session with Hobson, Renzo's brother.
Very cool. Hobson's fights for Bellator, right?
Yes, they're still waiting on a date. He's thinking September, maybe October. I do the podcast with Kiwan too. I don't know if you met Kiwan. Kiwan Gracie.
Yeah. I met him in London.
Oh yeah, that's where he lives. He lives with not with Roger, but he trains at Roger Gracie Academy there.
Yeah, I went in one day. Actually, I met Braulio Estima. Well, I've met him before, but I got to know him when we did a training camp in Puerto Rico, and I was heading to London after for a match, and I was like, yo, Braulio, what do I got to do to roll with Roger Gracie? Ooh. And he set it up, so I got to train with Roger for, I think we did 2 or 3 rounds, and yeah, Kiwan was there as well, so we're training with both of them.
That's
it
awesome.
Was pretty cool, because I was like, Roger sort of, it feels like he's, it's hard to get training rounds in with him. You know what I mean? He's like all the way in London. Yep. A lot of people dream of training with him and stuff. So I felt it was very cool to finally get to train with the legend himself.
It's amazing, right? And how was it? Just because I'm a blue belt, but I had this thing. I was going to California and I said, I want to do a private with Hickson. And I was texting and trying to get a hold of someone, and then I had to call Renzo. I say, Renzo, you got to hook me up here. Can you contact and make the connection so I can go and do a private with Hickson? He was like, yeah, I'll make that happen, my brother. Go. So I was in California. I was gonna stay there for like 10 days. That was like day 4, and I have no word. I was like, oh, fuck, it's not gonna happen, right? And then one day I got a text message to say, hey, this is Hickson. I was like, holy shit. So then I go and I had like a full flashback doing that whole session with him. He was amazing. And he was all, I had no idea what Renzo told him. So Renzo is a little crazy. So he probably say, this is one of my students here. He trains here at the academy. Yeah, and then he trains here at the academy translates to, you, Gordon Ryan, John Danaher. So Hickson's probably like, what the fuck this guy wants to do with me? And he's like, so are you training for competition? I was like, no. So I don't know what Renzo told you, but I'm a blue belt. I want to do like basic jiu-jitsu with you guys, because that I think that's what you guys are the best on. Like you have like, I don't know, 20 moves that you master that, and that's it's kind of like Roger jiu-jitsu, right? Everybody says it's a very basic but super efficient, and I told him, saying, I want to learn basics. So okay, you will be my pleasure, brother, to show you invisible jiu-jitsu. And I had a fit. I was like, oh, this is gonna be fucking awesome. So I did it. It was like a 3-hour thing. We did 40 minutes on breathing. And just go like from base and mount and sweeps. He was amazing. He was just amazing. That's kind of what I was like. So how was it? Because it feels like you had that thing like, how do I get a roll with the Roger? Right? It's like it's fucking Roger Gracie, right? So how was that for you? Like,
yeah, it's funny. Some of these guys are so like, you need a connection to get in there, right? Like, you need someone to open the door, because like, I mean, even for me, like on Instagram, I barely check my message requests and stuff like that. Like, yeah. It's like, but if a friend messages me to set something up, it's like a foot in the door, really. You make it happen.
Exactly.
But yeah, rolling with Hodja was cool. I went into his academy for an open mat, and there was like a room of like 40 people in gis training. and I was the only guy no-gi. So I'm waiting for Roger. I'm waiting for him to come in, and then eventually he comes. And I remember thinking, I didn't know what to expect because he almost seems very, very serious.
Uh-huh. Very too serious, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Like, he was pretty cool. I broke the ice by talking about his win over Bushesha at his retirement, and then he was much more relaxed and stuff. Yeah, but we rolled, and he beat the shit out of me, so it was pretty cool. I was like, all right, he still got it.
You guys did a no-gi or gi? No-gi, right?
No-gi, yeah. Before we slapped hands, he looked at me. I didn't even know if he knew who I was or anything. He looked at me and goes, oh, okay, leg lock master.
Oh, he knew.
Yeah. So then we rolled. It was cool to feel what he does so well. He's like, his defense is ridiculous, but he's his patience. And yeah, it's funny you mentioned the breathing exercises with Hickson. Like while I was rolling with Hodger, he was doing a lot of breathing things. Like he was, I can't even describe it, but I definitely could tell he was doing something with his breath work to control his energy.
Yeah, it's crazy. Hickson described that in a crazy way. He said he would drop his heartbeat. I don't know. I'm probably going to say some shitty number here, but so I can use it as an example. So he would drop his heartbeat to like 60, right? Or maybe 50 or whatever low heartbeat is. And just before the fight, he said like on the dressing room, that was all I would concentrate. He was dropping my heartbeat. So I would walk into the ring with my heartbeat really low. So let's say he was 50. Say I get in there, I'm at 50. My opponent, it's already at 80. Because he's excited, he's warming up, and he's jumping around, and then the fight starts. So now my heartbeat goes to 60, and my opponent, it's almost at 100. So because we already trading punches, and I'm still thinking on controlling my cardio. So now my heartbeat, it's at 80, and my opponent, it's like 120. And he's already breathing hard, and now I just gotta wait. And they all have that, and it's crazy. And he said to me, if you get tired, no matter how good you are, it's like you're tired, you're done. So they have this mentality. I'm not sure all of them, but Roger definitely does. It was funny you said the Bushesha fight, because I did a podcast with Roger, and we did a breakdown of his Bushesha fight, and it was epic. I put it on the screen. And on the when I did the editing, I did like a picture-in-picture window here, and you can watch him explaining what he was doing, and he was doing just that. He was waiting for Bushesha to get tired.
Yeah. What did I say to him? I said I asked him about the Bushesha match, and I said what I liked most was that you had signed up to do an IBJJF Grand Prix, and you had the super fight. But the second you won the super fight, you retired from the sport. So you didn't give him a chance for a rematch.
Bushesha kind of said that. I did a podcast with Bushesha. He was kind of bummed by that. He's like, well, you know, you can force the guy to fight, but we were supposed to have a rematch.
Yeah, like I thought if Hodger had lost the super fight, he would have done the Grand Prix and had another shot at him. So I was like, Hodger played it pretty well. He left it open, so he had two chances, but Bushesha only had one.
Yeah, I praised him for taking that super fight because the talk was that he was going to be his last fight. But he had signed up already for the other tournament, but the talk was like that's going to be his last fight. And I was like, that's a fucking dangerous way to try to retire, right? It's like you get one of the top guys in the planet, the guy that almost beat you, and they say, well, that's why I chose him, because we did that one fight, it was a draw, but everybody, when they talk about the first fight, they remember the armbar, and they were like, right. Oh, if there's an extra minute there, he will have Roger, and say that's all people talk about it, so I wanted to be him.
It would have been cool if he did the Grand Prix, like we would have seen him versus Leandro Lowe, I think that was lined up. That would have been crazy to see.
Leandro Lowe, that's what really got a bunch of eyes on you, right? Like on the 2017 ADCC when you submit him?
Yeah, that was the one. They gave me Leandro first round because I was a Asian trials winner, and they sort of seed it, and Asian trials winners are considered the lowest rank of all the trials.
So good luck with that, right?
Yeah. I think they set me up with one of the top seeds because Leandro was considered Leandro had done that super fight with Gordon, and he won, but it was sort of controversial because they didn't give away any stalling penalties, really. Like, had it been ADCC, a real ADCC match, he would have been disqualified. So I think Leandro won because he shot two double leg takedowns. So everyone, basically, I mean, the details are important, but most people just remember Leandro beat Gordon. So I had Leandro first round. So yeah, it was a pretty tough setup. I really didn't know what to expect going into the match, but I reassured myself because I was like, Leandro's world-class, but he's not really a strong finisher. He doesn't finish a lot of opponents. So that gave me confidence because I was like, all right, so we got a no points period where I can really go, really chase after Leandro. And I was really basically expecting him not to turn it up till the points period. So it left me room to sort of breathe in that match.
And if it takes you down, it doesn't count, right? And then you can still work, right? That's genius thinking there.
Yeah, well, I had to tell myself something to reassure myself against one of the legends. You got to find one way to paint a positive picture.
When did you decide to make the move? When did you land the Hanzos? How did Gordon relationship started? That kind of stuff. How did you make your way here?
Well, it was actually I had that epic match with Gordon at the EBI. The one with the armbar, right? So yep. We had that match, and then the next week we both were competing on Kasai. And what was funny was Kasai Grappling had like four different locker rooms. So they put me in the locker room full of Hanzo Gracie. So, so I walk in the next week at the event, and I look around in the locker room, and I'm just like John Danaher, I was like Gordon, it's like Tom DeBlas. I was like, they really just put me in the Hanzo Gracie locker room. But over the course of the night, we're all pretty friendly, joking around. I think Danaher, because he's from New Zealand, he really enjoys speaking to people from that part of the world. So we got along pretty well, and those guys said to come train next week. And then from that point on, whenever I was in the States or wherever I was in the East Coast, I would start training more regularly with the guys. And it just worked out pretty well. But I didn't make the permanent move until March this year.
Mm-hmm. It's funny how jiu-jitsu has this friendship kind of thing, right? Because it's not something you see on MMA or something like that. Like, you have friends. Those guys probably have friends from the jiu-jitsu times, right? Like, say, hey, I'm in town. Hey, come train. We'll do some sparring and stuff. But the friendship really started back. You don't see like a opponent say, hey, come train with me, like let's spar together kind of thing. That just don't happen. It's just jiu-jitsu, right? You have this and I said that because jiu-jitsu guys deal with losses a lot better than regular fighters. Because you go into a tournament, let's say you do 10 tournaments in a year, you're gonna win 6-7, you do really well, and you lose 3. And it's all good. Life keeps moving, and it bothers because nobody likes to lose. But hey, life moves on, right? And then next week you're doing a different tournament, and then you win, and everything's good again. And MMA, they just don't have that. I think I think where in a place where you can knock out the other guy and really hurt him, that they don't give too much room for that type of friendship. And jiu-jitsu, we all think we, like I'm putting myself in there, but it's like I can improve training with that guy and I can improve training with that other guy, so let's all train together and we all get better. That kind of mentality rolls, right?
Yeah. Plus as well, like if I have a grappling match against someone, I mean, especially in the context of IBJJF events, like if someone beats me, it's unlikely that'll be the last time we compete against each other.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, like I could potentially have a tournament the next weekend, but I think for MMA it's so personal because like they do a 3-month camp thinking only about this one guy, then they go through an excruciating weight cut.
Yep.
Then they have the fight, and then they don't have anything else to think about until they book their next match. So exactly. That guy really is polarizing in your life for maybe 4 to 5 months. And like, if you get injured afterwards and you're suspended, then you're just stuck on the shelf thinking about this one guy. But I mean,
for almost a year now, right?
Yeah, that's your whole year. I've heard some cool stories though. Like, I heard Alexander Gustafsson early in his career got beaten by Phil Davis. And then Alexander and Phil started training together straight after. He was like, oh, I need to learn wrestling. He's like, I'm a Scandinavian. We didn't have great wrestling. And those guys linked up and started training. But yeah, very rare.
Very
rare. Probably takes two real gentlemen to make that
exactly.
to make that work.
I saw a guy, I don't remember his name now. He got caught on a crazy submission with Damian Maia. And he bumped into Damian Maia after in a backstage, and he asked Damian to show him the submission. Damian had just caught him on like 15 minutes before. And then there's some pictures, like, Damian, it's in the middle of this room, like laying on the ground, showing the guy who he just beat the submission. But again, that's rare. That never happens. Like, they get so sour quick. It's great. But that's just like you said, right? Like, it's the training camp, and the mentality is like, I want to fucking kill that guy, because if I don't want to kill him, he will want to kill me. And that's the kind of spirit they get in there too. And the other thing, like I said, it's if in jiu-jitsu you fight the same guy like a bunch of times, so you have your chance for revenge or like, not revenge, it's like it's a revenge, but like a match revenge, right? Not personal. But GSP said that very interestingly, because I asked him, like, he was always so cool and composed, and I was like, how hard it's to be cool and composed against a guy who already beat you. I brought up the Matt Hughes and Matt Serra rematch, the only two losses he has. Matt Serra, especially, he was in Canada, the first big event in Canada, with his entire family watching, like, first row. I was like, does that add extra pressure? And that's just what we're talking about. And he was like, oh, yes, it does, because you already lost to that guy once. You lose to him again, you're never seeing that guy again. Because it's just not. He's gonna be in such a level. You're gonna have to get like 3, 4 fights before you can even think about fighting that guy again. And that guy might not even be at that same spot anymore. He might be down. So it's gone. So you gotta go with everything you have. And jiu-jitsu, you just don't have that mentality, right? So it's awesome. Do you when is the next tournament, and what are you training for now?
I'm training for the rematch against Mason Fowler. But
I saw a post. It's like September, right? Like, or August. It's
I think, yeah, the last weekend in August. But I'm still trying to convince Chael Sonnen. I'm like, Chael, for the main event, we got to do more than 5 minutes.
Okay.
5 minutes regulation period's like not enough time. So right now I'm really trying to convince him. I'm like, we got to do 10 or 15 minutes, because there's sort of like there's two different ways people play the game. Like, for me, and I don't have a problem with it either way, because it is a game, people exploit the rules, you know. But like, for me, I want to go out there, I want to prove I'm better than my opponent. Ultimately, I want to either finish him or dominate him. And then if it goes to overtime, obviously we have to deal with the overtime. But then there's other people, like Mason sort of played a pretty anti-jiu-jitsu game. And he was hoping to win in the overtime. And I mean, it is what it is. Like, you can choose to play the game any way you want. Obviously, one's going to attract more fans, probably more people going to want to buy instructionals, go to seminars and stuff. One is winning by any means necessary. So it's like, if we can extend it past 5 minutes, hopefully we can force more action in the regulation. Because although we have the Jiu-Jitsu overtime tournament this weekend with Eddie Bravo's running, I don't think anyone really loves the overtime. They see it as a necessary evil, but no one really loves it. They'd rather see it, the action take place in the regulation period.
Bushesha, I asked him, I want to talk to you about your fight with Vinny Magalhães too, because that was one of the awkward moments that I seen. But Bushesha was pretty, when I was talking to him, I was asking about the ZBI stuff, submission only, and he doesn't like it. But he doesn't like the other formats either. He said, like, when you get to his level, people just try to like stall and they don't take risks just so they can say they had a good match against Buchecha because the stocks go up really quick. And he said, and that made almost impossible for me to compete because it's like nobody it's doing jiu-jitsu. They just like kind of try to have a good match against me, and that means like not letting me do anything, or they're not trying to do anything. And for the submission only thing, he had these big things like, so I don't think anyone should start on my back because they didn't deserve to get there.
Yeah, I see it. There's like the only problem is there's no real solution. You know what I mean? Like if we do golden score, first point wins, then again, if you're a wrestler, you're just going to force an overtime to golden score. So it's like, and I know what Bishesh is saying, where once you have a name, people, they just want to do well.
You just experienced that, right? You were just saying like he was just trying to be there with you and do well.
Even my previous opponent was a guy called Gabriel Checo. Gabriel's a pretty nice guy and stuff, but he basically did the same thing, but I was able to beat him in overtime. And he lasted 5 minutes in regulation. And I remember he put a post up afterwards being like, oh, everyone doubted me, but I survived 5 minutes. And I'm like, I get it. You're trying to build the name, but at the same time, it's like, that's not the goal here. Like for me, I would honestly rather someone destroy me in regulation.
At least they're going for it, right?
Yeah, someone just beats me. Even if they beat me in 20 seconds, I would feel better about that than some sort of strange anti-jiu-jitsu battle that ends up going in their favor. Like, I would honestly rather get dominated. Yeah. It sounds strange, but it actually doesn't
because then it's a real fight, right? Like you have your openings and the guy is really focused on beating you the way it's supposed to happen, not just, and then like you go to overtime, the guy starts on your back. That's the post that's the Instagram post picture, right? It's like he got Craig Jones back. It's like, hey guys, hey, my instruction, it's out for sale. I'll show you how to get that. It's crazy, man.
That's true. The other thing with EBI though, right, is like I was thinking as well, I used to believe that EBI was almost a more pure form of the rules because even like I was going to say the referee can't really interfere, like it's too clear, but obviously that cost me recently. But like basically with Bishesh, he doesn't want anyone to start on his back, but he still gets to start on that guy's back. And if Bishesh is better from the back, even if Bishesh gets submitted, as long as he submits the guy quicker than he submitted him, he still wins the match, you know? True. But like the first point and stuff, that one's really hard to navigate because I mean, if we do first point overtime, you're going to have two guys that are scared to shoot a takedown.
Yeah. I agree with you when you say there's no real solution for the problem. You just, there are different formats, right? I think what Eddie Bravo brought to the table and Meta Morris and the other events. What was the Helix Gracie one?
Oh, Halleck was he was running Metamoris.
Metamoris, yeah, and then Polaris and yes, I'm sorry. And then Eddie, I think they brought the excitement back, right? Because nobody can freaking watch like a IBJJF Gi Awards or something. It's crazy. It's just too much technique and it's so technical that it becomes boring. And I love jiu-jitsu, but like, I cannot sit and watch a fucking 2 hours of a Gi match and everybody's just trying to hold the other guy. He brought the excitement back, but then you have kind of almost like the same problems, like the guy stalls for 5 minutes because he knows he's gonna have a shot of your back at the end.
Yeah, the problem is we keep looking at jiu-jitsu like we need to find a rule set that makes jiu-jitsu exciting, but really, like, I mean, a guy like Gary Tonin, put him in any rule set, he's gonna be excited.
Yeah.
So it's the individual athlete's responsibility to make it exciting. And really, I mean, I should say it's both guys' responsibility. If you put two exciting athletes, two guys that want it in any rule set, it will be exciting. And I think a lot of the guys that play the game a little too much, they don't realize what it costs them.
Yes.
Because you could win an ADCC gold medal. That's the pinnacle of the sport. But if you if you do it in a boring way, you're not gonna reap the benefits of your career. You're not gonna get the sponsorships, not necessarily get the podcast appearances, sell instructionals and stuff. It's almost better like to be a Gary Tonin, yeah, who got a bronze medal at ADCC in some sense. Like if your desire is to really grow the sport, if your desire is to grow your bank account,
yeah,
you know what I mean? Like I really believe not all victories are created equal. I mean, it's easy for me to say because I haven't won any major gold medals. I'll mainly win the super fights, not the golds. But that's the way I look at it. Like if we look at the iconic performances in ADCC history, it's going to be a Marcelo. It's going to be a Hodger. It's going to be a Crone.
Yeah.
Obviously, those guys that pull off the impossible, that win and win with all submissions.
That Crone fight against Gary Tonin was one of the craziest fights, right?
Oh, probably the best match ever.
Yeah.
In ADCC history,
that was,
I think.
That was amazing. But listen, you are the perfect example for what you're just saying. You just said like, oh, I haven't won any major gold medals or something like that. And you are one of the most respected jiu-jitsu guys just because of your game, right? It's like, doesn't matter if you don't have 10 ADCCs in your back, you are just relevant as the guy who does because of your game and the way you play and what you seek when you're there, and that makes all the difference. I want to talk about that Vini Magalhães fight. What happened there? Because it was that crazy. You guys stopped kind of fighting, and there's a chat going on, and you're talking to him, he's talking to you, and you're both talking to a referee. We all know the result now, but what happened in that moment? Try to describe it here.
Well, I mean, even leading up to the match, I'd seen Gary come very close, Gordon come close to heel hooks. Like they got close to not finishing it, but they got close to good positions to finish it. So I remember in myself, I was like, maybe he can't be heel hooked. I was really thinking that, but then at the end of the day, no matter how invincible someone seems, like you gotta believe in the technique. And I was like, well, if he can't be heel hooked, I want to know for myself if it's you know what I mean. I'm gonna put him in a position, test it out. And for Vinny, he has incredibly flexible knees and ankles. So usually, when people apply a heel hook, those two aspects of his flexibility save him. But for me, and I don't know, maybe it's because it's later in his career and stuff. Obviously, he's been doing it a long time. But the weakest link in the chain was his shin bone, his fibula. So the first heel hook I put him in, I heard a crack, but I didn't know how bad it was. And it cracked. He didn't even flinch. He tried to attack my heel. He actually caught my heel briefly and twisted it a little bit, but I slipped out. And then the first discussion was, I was just like, oh, respect. Like, I just gave him props for that because we both paused afterwards. And then the second time I got him in the heel hook, when I applied it, there was no resistance. There was no, like, and I remember twisting it and seeing one of his bones poking through the skin. And I remember,
oh, no.
Yeah, I was pulling on it. He's not reacting.
Holy
and then,
shit.
Then it slipped out. So we stopped. And I remember just, because, I mean, I don't want to hurt anyone, even if
exactly.
I don't. Yeah, I'm not. Like, I always want my opponent to have an opportunity to tap.
Yeah, you know? That's so what I was gonna say. You when you go for a heel hook, you don't start 100% to try to break the fucking guy's feet, right? Like, you put the pressure and you give them a chance to say, "Hey, dude, this is going on. Are you gonna tap or not?" And then you put more pressure, right?
Yeah, I mean, as long as. I can isolate their hips. If their hips are isolated, then the submission can be quick or slow. You know what I mean? But like for Vinny, I remember just talking to him after that second one. I was just like, "Are you okay? Like, are you?" Because like, I knew it was broken, and he wasn't reacting in his face. And I remember thinking like maybe he doesn't know. Like, I would want to know if someone broke something of mine and I wasn't paying attention somehow by some miracle. I didn't feel it. I'd want him to be like, "Yo, bro, that's pretty bad." So I was giving him a moment to just stop and look at it. And he said something like, "Oh, I think you broke my shin." And I was like, "Are you sure you want to keep going?" And he's like, I was like, "Are you sure you want to keep going? It's pretty bad." And he's like, "Yeah, it's already broken." And then we kept going for a
bit.
That's
fucking crazy. Yeah, just keep going. It's already broken.
I was looking at his ankle starting to swell up. And eventually he was like, he asked the referee. Because another thing we don't know with Submission Underground, well, you're not allowed to have coaches. So you don't know how long's left in the regulation period. Mm. So when Vinny turned to us, the ref, he's like, how long's left? Because I remember thinking, oh, Vinny wants to go to overtime and try and win in overtime. But he actually just wanted to survive regulation so he could continue to say he hasn't been submitted in regulation since, I think, Hodger Gracie, like 15 years ago or something. So I remember thinking, this guy's crazy. But then the referee called it, and Vinny was like, okay.
He was like 2-3 minutes out or something like that.
There
was a lot of time left, right, for overtime.
And I had another guy there. Was Ethan Krellison was with me, and he tried to coach illegally. They told him off for it, but I remember he yelled something out like, Craig, just stand up. As in, that's what I should have done. I should have stood up to see how he could walk on it.
Yeah. Oh, yes, that's right.
But in the moment, I was like, it was just a confusing moment because I was like, yo, like Vinny jokes around on the internet and stuff, and he has his thing, leg locks don't work.
I was just gonna ask that. Do you think I really believe that was 100% of the reason he didn't tamper. He had that legs lock don't work with Gordon, right? Like right after he won by points and stuff. Like leg locks don't work, and then he got caught on a leg lock, and he's like, I'm not fucking tapping for this.
I think that was it as well. That's like the hesitation. I believe he had just made a rash guard or something to sell online the week before, and leading up to the match, he was posting some stuff on Twitter and stuff. And that's the thing with Vinny. Vinny would joke around and stuff. Like, I know he truly doesn't believe it, you know, but like, he's just. Vinny's a pretty nice guy in that sense.
It's like, a marketing tool, right? Like, hey, I'm the guy who leg locks don't work kind of thing.
Yeah. Like, I would say me and Vinny go about shit talking a little bit in a similar fashion. You know what I mean? It's sort of like, it's not serious. We're just joking around, but it still does do a good job to hype up a match.
Bad, for sure. And at the end of the match, they ask him something about that. So it kind of happened, right? You got submission? No, I wasn't submitted. I didn't tap.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, whatever floats your boat.
we'll let him have it. Eh? But I mean, I guess in a grappling event, if I was the referee and I saw a guy's shin break, I'd be like, look, man, like, especially during COVID, the last thing you want to do is send Vinny Margalesh to hospital
with
a leg injury for an event that shouldn't have been happening anyway.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. What I remember, I think that one specifically, it was like a undisclosed location and it was hidden or something like that, right? Is this next one too? No, it's kind of like...
Well, they're still in an undisclosed location, but the previous four were in a southern part of Oregon. It was in a barn that had been repurposed for weddings or something, like on a vineyard. And the latest one was in a TV studio in an undisclosed spot. I think, I don't know if they're still allowed to do it yet. Chael Sonnen does whatever he wants typically. But he did tell me, he said, yo, if the governor calls, he's like, we'll shut it down. But he's like, and if the governor doesn't contact me, we're going ahead.
Yeah, kind of. That UFC paid the price for that. At that same time, right? Because I remember watching Dana White. They secure a casino in an Indian reservation in California. Remember that?
That's right. Yeah.
And Dana White was like, "We're not telling people where the UFC is going to be." And that was this whole thing. It's like he kind of said, as soon as the public finds out where that's going to be, they're going to shut it down. No matter if it's an Indian reservation, if it's on a fucking sky or whatever, something's going to happen. He had that feeling. He didn't want to let people know. And it was like a week before the fight, they caught a hold where the event was going to happen. And then like a senator from California or a congresswoman or stuff is like, you shouldn't be doing this. And then the pressure just built that they was like, all right. Then ESPN kind of got involved and say, hey, don't do it, and that's when he pulled off. And
yeah, like the bosses at the very top told him to stop, right? But Dana did an interview with Chael Sonnen where he kept joking around about the same time. He's like, how are you getting away with this?
Because nobody knows where it's at.
Yeah.
that makes 100% of the sense. Look, let's you're going to train today, right? It's Sunday, it's probably like 150 degrees out. And I'm gonna let you go, so we don't delay your training. Let's stay in touch. As soon as something gets scheduled, maybe maybe a little bit before your fight, we'll get together again. We'll do like a breakdown or something like that. That would be awesome to happen.
Oh, for sure, awesome. Thank you very much for having me on.
Hey, I appreciate it, Craig, man. Thanks so much, man. Happy Sunday. Train hard, and thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thanks, bro. See ya.
Appreciate it, brother.